Today is Wednesday, June 14th. We're going to wrap up information on blood vessels today. Okay, so on page 51, we were talking in class on Monday about various types of blood vessels. I just want to remind you that blood vessels typically have three primary layers. The middle layer is the one that varies between arteries and veins. So whereas arteries operate under high pressure and need a strong or a stretchy tunica media, what about veins? Do they operate under high pressure? No, they don't. They actually operate under very low pressure, sometimes even negative pressure. So what does that tell us to expect for their tunica media? Yep, smaller, not quite so muscular. Don't necessarily need to be as stretchy because we're not dealing with high pressure here. So that's one of the issues we're looking at. The blood in our veins is being transported back to the heart. It's low pressured, so we have a thinner walled tunica media. And we typically have a larger opening or a larger diameter. These veins are considered blood reservoirs because around 60% of your blood at any given time is sitting in one of your veins. So, you know, that's probably good news because you do have a lot of blood that's sitting in veins in case an artery happens to be severed. There's still some blood making its way back to the heart. We know that most veins are colored blue on our models because they normally carry deoxygenated blood. Where's the exception?
Pulmonaries.
Good. So, of course, pulmonary veins are red and pulmonary arteries are blue. So just got to keep that one in mind. Well, since veins operate under such very low pressure and they're working against gravity to pull blood back to your heart, there have to be some things to assist us with blood flow return. One of the things we may expect to see in our larger veins are these things called valves. We've been here before. What do valves in the heart prevent from happening? Good. Same concept here. Again, backflow is what we want to prevent from happening. So I wanted to show you that skeletal muscles sit around those valves. When you move, the contraction of the muscle milks the blood through that vessel. And as it pulls it through, the blood is not able to backflow thanks to the valve that's in place. So, you know, I know a lot of you are going to either be working on your feet or you currently have jobs where you stand on your feet for 12 hours a day. You know, standing is going to be gravity's friend, right? Because gravity's going to want to pull that blood down. So simply by moving around, shifting your weight, bending your knees, you can help get that blood to flow back to your heart. So physical activity and using those skeletal muscles to help those valves, they kind of go hand in hand here with moving that blood back. Speaking of skeletal muscle activity, simply being physically active is another way to help move the blood through those valves. So skeletal muscles and movement are good ways to circulate our blood. All right, and then finally, we've got this issue of being a respiratory pump. Let me get you there. Oh, I thought I had a picture. I do not. So in terms of breathing, respiration actually lowers the pressure in our thoracic cavity, and that too will help to pull the blood back to the heart from basically high to low pressure along that pressure gradient. So I fast-forwarded through a couple of pictures I wanted to show you. These valves are like trapdoors. Okay, these valves are like trapdoors. As blood flows through them, they shut behind. A lot of pressure can actually cause these valves to fail. We call that in the larger veins a varicose vein problem. So what are some things that may happen to your body that would cause an increased pressure on those valves? Weight. Yep. Extra weight could do it. Females are especially at risk for pregnancy, right? So pregnancy can do it too. And of course, that adds extra weight. So the case of a varicose vein is the valve has failed. And unfortunately, that means blood can backflow through that vessel. They have treatments nowadays that can seal off those failed veins and failed valves. So we do have a workaround for this very painful problem. I do want to mention that, you know, hemorrhoids are also varicose veins. That's one reason why straining for a bowel movement can put a lot of pressure on the valves in those veins. And that's why we're recommended not to push when we have a bowel movement. So as we know that, you know, how hemorrhoids work, they can bleed. And the more pressure, the more strain you have during a bowel movement, the more likely you are to accumulate blood there that can't get back through those failed veins or failed valves, too. Questions so far? Okay. Very bottom of your page, you got a blank to fill in. So we know small arteries are called arterioles. The blank down there, small veins are called venules. Good. Yep, small veins are called venules. Spell it, it's V-E-N-U-L-E-S. Small veins are called venules. That's right, V-E-N-U-L-E-S. So kind of cool picture here to take a look at an artery versus a vein. You'll notice the artery on the right does have a very thick tunica media. That is the middle layer here. Looks pretty muscular. Looks like there's quite a few elastic fibers in there. This vein over here on the left, you'll notice, has a rather thin tunica media. So it's all about the pressure that we're having to withstand that makes those two vessels structurally different. Another look here, you'll see a really thick one. There's a thick tunica media. Just for sake of comparison, we know that arterioles are simply smaller arteries. Venules are smaller veins, and we're talking diameter here. So you'll notice here we've got a small vessel, very small diameter. You've got the blood cells inside traveling through, but notice again, the tunica media is greatly reduced when you've got one of those smaller vessels. Why do you think that's the case for a smaller vessel? Like a venule, for instance. What does it tell you about the pressure inside that vessel? Lower. Yep, so that's just what we're looking for there. Let's see. Finally, let's flip the page and talk about capillaries on the top of 52. So these have only one tunic, and it is tunica intima, composed only of tunica intima. All right, so we know tunica intima is made up of only a single layer of epithelial tissue. All right, what type? Good, simple squamous is right, good. So very thin, single cell layer of tissue here, that's all we've got. And when you look at a capillary like this one or even this one, you'll notice that it is so small that blood cells have to travel through single file. You know, red blood cells are flexible. They're kind of like, you know, bendable, so when they pass through this very tight vessel, they can fold in on themselves and then emerge back fully, you know, structured as they exit the capillary. So capillaries do serve most of our tissues. They're in very close proximity to most cells and tissues. We know there are a few exceptions for avascular tissues. Thinking back to Bio-210, can you tell me some avascular tissues? Avascular, no vessels.
The epithelial.
Epithelial, good.
Connective?
Some connectives like cartilage. Yeah. Yep, so most tissues are not too far from a capillary, and of course, the ones that don't have a direct blood supply will pick it up by diffusion. I did want to mention to you that capillaries come in different forms. The capillaries that form your blood-brain barrier are called closed capillaries. And like the name implies, they do not allow much exchange, except for gas exchange, with the surrounding cells and tissues. Thinking back to Bio-210, how does the brain tissue get nutrients?
Cerebrospinal fluid.
That's it. Yep, so tight junctions, astrocytes, keep those capillaries in the brain closed. Other places in the body, we have what's called a fenestrated capillary. These are porous. They allow for a great deal of exchange with the surrounding tissues. And your liver and spleen are two good examples of organs that have fenestrated capillaries. I should tell you that the word fenestra means window in Latin. So I kind of get the sense that there's a lot of openings or pores on a fenestrated capillary. Likewise, capillaries don't exist as a simple connector between an arteriole and a venule. They are more set up as a network or a capillary bed. So that's what we've got here, is a network called a capillary bed. They show the color change from red to blue. A lot of times they'll show capillaries as purple because this is where gas exchange occurs for our bodies. So which gas is diffusing out of our capillary bed? Oxygen, yeah. And which gas is diffusing into the capillary bed?
CO2,
yeah. So, of course, gas exchange is one major function for our capillaries. We also have fluids exchanged here, which we'll cover today. Other things that are exchanged here include nutrients and waste products. So the thin-walled nature is critical for getting things exchanged at our capillary beds. If you don't have the thin walls, it's simply too thick for other items to pass through in, say, an artery or a vein. So the whole structure here lends itself to, you know, exchanges. Back in Bio210, you probably learned a little bit about what happens when you're hot versus what happens when you're cold. So what happens to your blood flow when you're hot?
Increases.
So you actually get increased blood flow to the dermis and the upper regions of your skin. And when you're cold, we know those vessels constrict. And what we don't actually tell you, because we hadn't covered capillaries yet, is there are little sphincters, little valves that close off blood flow through those capillary beds. So when you're warm, we may in fact open up all those capillary sphincters, let that blood flow through, and then your skin looks red or feels warm to the touch. When you're cold, those sphincters may close, and that keeps the blood flow regulated strictly from an arterial to a venule. So that's just one example of when we may see those capillary sphincters open and close. So it's a good way for us to regulate blood flow to certain areas of the body. Let's see, dead center of that page, you've got a summary of systemic and pulmonary circulation. You'll notice that the capillaries are the sites of exchange for both of those flow pathways. All right, so we're going to switch gears. We're done with anatomy, and I'd like to know if you have any questions before we dive off the deep end into the physiology. That's comforting, isn't it? And I haven't had my caffeine, so I'm sleepy. Okay. What we're going to do for the remainder of this chapter is cover physiology of circulation. And there's two big topics now that we're going to hit. The first one is blood pressure and how you regulate it. That's coming up right now. And then later, after the break, we're going to cover bulk fluid transport. So I need to give you a little background information on circulation and blood pressure. So let's start with that. Let's see, we're on the bottom of page 52. So blood pressure is the pressure exerted by the blood in your vessels. I know that sounds like you're defining the term with the terms, but it is a force that keeps your blood circulating around your body. So what creates blood pressure? What organ pumps to create blood pressure?
The heart,
right? So ultimately, the push of the blood against the walls of your vessels originates with the force generated by your heart. We do measure blood pressure in millimeters mercury. That's that mmHg we talked about on Monday. I'm just checking to see if anybody needs this slide. Sure. Anybody else need it? So this picture is in your course pack. It's actually on the top of page 53. I know you all have talked about mean arterial pressure, or MAP, in lab. And I know you take into account two pressures when you calculate that. What are they? Good. Systolic and diastolic pressure. So to appreciate that, we're going to look at the aorta here, and you'll notice that we're kind of going back and forth between a systolic pressure around 120 and a diastolic pressure of around 80. So that's exactly what we would expect to see on the left side of the heart. Keep in mind the right side of the heart pressure is much lower. Do you recall what right side pressure is? 24 over 8. Yeah, really, really low. So all of this conversation is what the left side of the heart is generating. So you'll notice we've got the mean arterial pressure here a little bit lower than 100, and it continues to decline from the aorta as we travel through the blood flow. You actually get the pulsation of diastolic and systolic pressure as you go through the aorta, the elastic arteries close to the heart, and the muscular arteries, which are a little further away. You start losing that pulse when you get to your arterioles. So what that tells me is you can take your pulse in the aorta, the elastic arteries, and the muscular arteries. But by the time I get to the arterioles, I've lost that pulsation of systolic and diastolic pressure, and I get simply a steady flow of blood traveling through. Okay? So by the time you reach the arterioles, you'll notice that our mean arterial pressures drop down here into the 70s. From this point, look how it drops like a rock. In the arterioles, we drop drastically down to the mid-30s by the time you exit. What type of vessel does an arteriole feed into? Capillaries, yeah. What happens to the diameter? Smaller. What happens to the distance from the heart? Getting pretty far, aren't we? So all that push that was behind the blood leaving the aorta is really starting to dwindle as we get over here to the capillaries. So the capillaries have some pressure. It's enough to allow for exchanges to occur. And then once you reach these veins, notice the pressure drops off pretty much to zero. So back on page 52, let me help you answer some of those questions. All right, so to start off with, which vessel has the highest blood pressure? I'm talking mean arterial pressure here.
Aorta.
Yep, aorta has the highest. And the steepest drop in blood pressure occurs in what type of vessel?
Arterioles.
Yeah, arterioles. So it comes in somewhere in the mid-70s, drops to the mid-30s. Okay, so you'll notice that when we get to capillary beds, we're looking at another drop in blood pressure, and then we continue to decline to around 0 millimeters mercury once you reach those veins. Do you have questions so far? Let's see, on page 53, let's talk about two factors affecting blood pressure. On Monday, we talked about cardiac output. On average, how much blood is a typical person circulating? 5 liters, good. We know that cardiac output is directly dependent upon two factors, heart rate and stroke volume. So if heart rate increases, so does stroke volume, and so does cardiac output. We know that those are directly proportional to one another. Hang on to that thought, because now we're going to talk about blood pressure. We know that blood pressure is directly dependent upon cardiac output and this thing called PR. Okay, it's not Puerto Rico, it's peripheral resistance. And this resistance is anything that impedes blood flow. In your course pack, below that picture, about halfway down your page, it says that cardiac output is the main determinant of blood pressure. That means it is the primary influence over blood pressure. I would mark that, highlight it, circle it, put a star around it, maybe do all of it, because that is going to come back to us over and over. It's the primary influence on blood pressure. Okay, so dead center of the page, cardiac output is the main determinant of blood pressure. That means it is the primary influence, the most important factor influencing blood pressure. So if a person has low blood pressure, the easiest way to influence blood pressure is to influence cardiac output. So we're going to learn that cardiac output, how much blood you're circulating, is going to be the number one influence over what your pressure is. Sure, peripheral resistance is important, but the way to change it immediately is to alter how much blood you're circulating. So let's talk about cardiac output for just a moment. Cardiac output is dependent on how much blood you've got. We know it's on average around 5 liters of blood. Going back to what we discussed in the blood chapter, about how much of your blood is composed of plasma? 55%, good. And that means the other 45% comes from formed elements. Yeah, and you're right, red blood cells are the most common type of formed element. So what would being dehydrated do to your cardiac output? Decrease it, right. What do you think being dehydrated does to your blood pressure? Decreases it, yeah. Let's talk about another one. Let's talk about having polycythemia. What does that do to your blood cardiac output? Increases it. What do you think that does to your blood pressure? Same thing, increases it, right. So anything that changes your blood volume or the number of red blood cells you've got, it's going to have a big influence over your blood pressure. Why do you think white blood cell and platelet populations have a very low influence over blood pressure? You got so few of them, right? So that 1% buffy coat is made up of those white blood cells and platelets. They have a very small influence on your overall blood pressure. So the two big ones, of course, blood plasma, formed elements, being specific, those erythrocytes influence your pressure and your cardiac output. Let's turn our attention to the runner-up, which is peripheral resistance. This is something else that also influences blood pressure, but it's not as important as how much blood you're circulating. So let's talk through blood viscosity first, because this is the thickness of the blood that you're circulating. So I want you to think about milkshakes for just a moment, because it's a hot summer day, and that sounds pretty tasty right now. So if you've got a really thick milkshake and just a regular drinking straw, how much do you have to suck to get that milkshake to come up through that straw?
Until
your brain pops out, right? So there's a lot of work when you've got thick milkshakes. Same thing here. If you've got thick blood, there has to be work behind pumping that blood around your body. So the term viscosity deals with the thickness of our fluids. What are some things that might cause your blood to become more viscous?
Dehydration.
Okay, so how does dehydration make you more viscous? What happens to your blood plasma when you're dehydrated?
It decreases,
right. And then what happens to the thickness of your blood?
It increases.
It increases, yeah. Yep, so the thickness increases. What are some other things that might cause your blood to become thicker? Polycythemia, that's another one, good. So that is more what? Red blood cells, good. Let's do it the other direction. What are some things that might make your blood less viscous? Anemia, right. What is that problem? Too little red blood cells, good. And what about your water content? How could you alter that to make your blood less viscous? Drink more, yeah. So drinking fluids helps to dilute down the formed elements and other things that are in your blood. So how easy is that? You can drink fluids and change the viscosity of your blood immediately, which influences the resistance and the blood flow. So there we go. We've got blood viscosity is one issue that can influence blood pressure. We know it's not nearly as important as cardiac output, but like I said, this is the runner-up of, you know, issues. Let's talk about the next one. Let's say that we've got the perfectly thickened milkshake. And I've got for you two options, a regular old foot-long drinking straw Or you're welcome to borrow my garden hose to drink your milkshake. It's got a big diameter, but it's 50 feet long. What's your option? What do you pick?
Straw.
Why? Why drink the straw?
Because it's
shorter. Yeah.
Shorter.
You don't pass out from sucking on that thing. Yeah. So the catch here is vessel length matters, because if you've got shorter vessels, blood can get to the destination quicker, and there is less force required to pump that blood a shorter distance. If you've got a long distance to pump that blood, what does the heart have to do? Work harder, right. And the harder it works, what happens to your pressure? Goes up, yeah. So vessel length is not something we can change right now at this given minute, but over time we can. How can you reduce your vessel length? That's a stump question, huh? What happens when you lose weight to your body tissues? Yeah, you shrink, yeah. So there's less distance for your body to pump that blood. You've probably heard that people who have excess weight are often told to lose weight to reduce their blood pressure. And you think, well, what the heck does my weight have to do with it? It's this. Yep, so gain weight makes your vessels longer. Losing weight makes your vessel length shorter overall. Let's see, the last one here has to do with the diameter of the vessel. And we know that the aorta has a rather big diameter. In fact, it's bigger in diameter than your thumb. When you get to the capillaries, they are small, so small that you can't see them with the naked eye. So we're talking extremely tiny in terms of vessel diameter. So let's go back to our milkshake example. If I've given you the perfectly thickened milkshake and I give you the option of one of those big fat milkshake straws or one of those tiny coffee stirrers, how does the blood flow easily, more easily? The bigger straw, yeah. So everybody wants the big drinking straw for the milkshake. You have to work less hard to get it through. So what is your heart doing when you've got miles and miles of teeny tiny capillaries to feed with blood? Working harder. And what does that do to your blood pressure? Increases it, right. So to summarize, let's go back. Things that make your heart work harder: thicker blood, longer vessels, and what about this?
Constriction.
Yes, smaller vessels, constricted vessels. Okay, so things that make your heart work hard: thicker blood, longer vessels, and constricted smaller vessels. Milkshake sounds really good right now. Okay, feel okay so far with this stuff? Anything I can clear up for you before we turn the page? Everything? You sure? Okay. All right, if you flip the page with me at the very top, we're going to talk about the cardiovascular center. And like its name implies, it controls both heart and vessels. Where is the cardiovascular center located? Medulla oblongata, good. Way back in Bio-210, you may have learned the medulla oblongata is home to four control centers: vomiting, respiration, and then of course this one. So we're going to really start to go into detail about what this one's going to be responsible for. That cardiovascular center has two portions, a cardiac center and a vasomotor center. The cardiac center specifically is innervated to the heart to control heart rate. The vasomotor center is specifically controlling vessel diameter. So let's go back. There were three types of peripheral resistance that influenced blood pressure. One was vessel or blood thickness, vessel length, and vessel diameter. So you notice that what your body says it can control right now is the vessel diameter, and we do that using our vasomotor center. So a piece of your brain actually controls vessel diameter. On Monday, I mentioned to you that the vessels have sympathetic innervation. Do they have parasympathetic?
No.
No parasympathetic innervation. So on Monday, I used the analogy of driving your car without a brake pedal. So it's either you step on the gas and you increase sympathetic stimulation, or you take your foot off the gas and you just coax, which decreases sympathetic stimulation. There is not a real direct way to make your vessels relax. You just have to take your foot off the gas and coast. And so eventually your vessels will start to relax and dilate once again. What does dilation do to your vessels and the pressure?
It decreases
pressure. Yes, it opens them up, lets you have more room for blood to flow through, and yet pressure decreases. Okay, so I just want to remind you that it's bolded and underlined up there near the top of your page. There is no parasympathetic innervation to the vessels, just sympathetic innervation. All right, so we're going to talk about what inputs go to the cardiovascular center. You'll notice that the higher brain center, such as your emotional state, can influence your cardiovascular center. So if you're upset, anxious, nervous, whatever, you know, that falls into that category, that influences your higher brain centers and your cardiovascular center. What do baroreceptors pick up on?
Pressure,
right. So pressure changes are going to play a role there. And then finally, you'll notice chemoreceptors also play a role in feeding information back. So chemoreceptors pick up on chemical changes in the bloodstream. Okay, so what we're going to talk through, starting here with this chart, are three ways to control blood pressure. We're going to talk about the neural control, which is your vasomotor center, first. Then we'll talk about chemical control, and then hormonal control. So we're going to spend a good deal of time first here on this neural control. So let's take a moment and look at this relationship between the brain, the heart, and the vessels. You'll notice there's a feedback loop here that involves the vagus nerve to the heart. There's also the glossopharyngeal nerve. And of course, the brain stem is picking up on information coming from your body. So blood pressure changes can be fed back to your brain, as well as chemical changes in your bloodstream. So the control of blood pressure here is a negative feedback loop. What the brain decides should work against the stimulus. So we're trying to inhibit or stop whatever feedback loop has already been turned on. Okay, so I'm going to walk you through a few examples, and then I'm going to cut you loose with a few on the next page. Let's talk about high blood pressure, and I'm going to use the chart down below to walk you through this. Let's say that you are stressed out. You know, somebody told you that, oh, coming up in lab today, you have a really big test, and you completely forgot about that test. So now you're stressed out, your blood pressure is increased, and let's walk through what your brain's going to do. All right, so there are baroreceptors that are in your aortic arch and your common carotid arteries. These baroreceptors pick up on blood pressure changes. They carry this information by way of some of those cranial nerves over here to your brain stem, specifically to the medulla. In the medulla, we've got that cardiovascular center. And the cardiovascular center says, oh, I just got a message that we have blood pressure that's too high. And so what does your brain think we should do when blood pressure is too high?
Decrease it, yeah.
So we're going to decrease blood pressure, but it's kind of like a 1-2 punch. We're not only going to tell the blood pressure to decrease, we're also going to tell the heart rate to
decrease,
yeah. So we're using both of those to help slow down that blood pressure. So what we're going to do is turn on some effector. Is it the sympathetic nervous system we want to turn on, or parasympathetic? Why is parasympathetic your best choice? Slows it down. Good. What is the cranial nerve that innervates your SA node?
Vagus.
Good. And the neurotransmitter that it releases? Acetylcholine, good. So the message comes back by way of vagus nerve to your SA node. The vagus nerve is a brake pedal, and it says, slow down that heart rate, releases acetylcholine, and heart rate drops. Okay? There's a little innervation down here to your AV node and your Purkinje fibers. We're not going to really touch on that. I'm just going to mainly focus on that vagus nerve telling your SA node to stop and slow it down. Okay, now, can we tell the vessels through parasympathetic stimulation to dilate?
No.
Because there is no parasympathetic, right. So we can't necessarily tell them, hey, dilate, but we can tell them a different message. What is that? Well, decrease blood pressure. And how do you do that if you can't tell it to do it through parasympathetic? Stop the sympathetic innervation, right? So you stop sending messages to stay constricted. Rather, you just stop sending that message, and eventually the vessel will open, relax, and dilate. That is not fast, by the way. That takes 30 minutes or more for your vessel to finally open up and dilate. But eventually we get there. So, to repeat, what was our stimulus?
High
blood pressure. And how did we solve the problem? Let's do the heart. Parasympathetic to the heart. SA node did what? Slow down. Good. And what instead did we do with our vessels?
We dilated
them. We didn't do it through parasympathetic. Instead, we stopped
sympathetic.
That's it. And I did want to point out, these are arterioles that they're oftentimes illustrating. They're the ones that are going to be told to dilate, and that increases blood flow. Okay, so pressure is picked up on by baroreceptors. Chemical changes are picked up on by chemoreceptors. Let's tackle a chemoreceptor issue. I'm just going to pick one out of that list there. It looks like we've got acidosis as a problem. So let me use exercise as an example here. We know that during exercise, we can make something called lactic acid. And there's that word, acid. The more lactic acid you build up in the bloodstream, the more acidic your bloodstream can become. So acidosis is going to be a stimulus picked up on by chemoreceptors in your aortic arch and common carotid arteries. Those chemoreceptors send the message back to your cardiovascular center, and the cardiovascular center says, the blood pH is falling below 7.35, becoming too acidic. What we need to do is get rid of the acid and get the blood pH back up to 7.35. So, how do we fix the problem? Turn on sympathetic or turn on parasympathetic? Turn on the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so let's take that innervation back to the SA node. Are we using the vagus nerve? No, because who does the vagus nerve work for? Parasympathetic, right? So we're not going to use the vagus nerve here. This time we're using sympathetic innervation, and we're using those two neurotransmitters that behave as hormones.
Epinephrine
and norepinephrine, good. So those chemicals now are flooding your bloodstream. They target beta receptors on your heart. Now what happens to heart rate? Goes up. Okay, so let's think big picture here. If you are exercising and you're in lactic acidosis, that acid needs to be removed from your bloodstream through your respiratory system. How does speeding up your heart rate help this? Breathe it out faster, right. The faster your heart pumps, the quicker we can send the blood to the lungs, and the faster you can exhale that acid out of your bloodstream. So that's why you breathe fast when you're exercising. You're actually getting rid of acid that could cause problems for your blood pH. So next time you climb the stairs in this building, you know, sometimes you hit second, third, fourth floor, you start becoming the heavy breather. Okay, that is about not just getting oxygen in, but more importantly, getting the CO2 out. So CO2 behaves as an acid in your bloodstream. All right, so we took care of the SA node. Do we have sympathetic innervation to your vessels?
Yes.
So what happens to your vessels? They constrict. And now when you squeeze your vessels, what happens to blood pressure?
Increases.
Right. So I want you to notice that when we're dealing with the problem and we're trying to find a solution, the solution is to increase heart rate and blood pressure together. Or in the previous case, we decreased heart rate and we decreased blood pressure together. Your body does not compensate by increasing one and decreasing the other. It's just not wired that way. So, you know, the catch is we increase sympathetic or we decrease sympathetic and increase para. So that's kind of one less step you have to worry about figuring out. We're not going to worry about the reasons behind these chemicals until we get into respiratory, one step at a time, right? So you'll notice that there are oxygen, CO2, and pH issues that influence heart rate and blood pressure. So what I'd like to do is cut you free for a few minutes, let you work together on page 55, and then I'll get back with you in a few minutes and we'll do answers. If you guys need help, holler, I'll come around and help you. Okay, so what I'd like to do is just kind of summarize what's going on here with those practice problems. I just want to repeat that blood pH, oxygen, and CO2 levels can influence a chemoreceptor to set off a warning signal. Likewise, blood pressure problems can set off a baroreceptor to send a warning signal to the brain. So just to kind of give you a sneak preview of where we're heading, the reason CO2 is such a concern is because it behaves as an acid in your bloodstream. That's why you'll notice on the chart that CO2 and blood pH are actually linked. So above 7.45, we're dealing with an alkaline blood pH. Below 7.35, we're dealing with an acid pH. And the issue is, the more CO2 you have in your bloodstream, the more acid your bloodstream becomes. So we'll take care of all the hows and whys of that when we get into the respiratory, but it's based on what you're looking at. Here's a couple of chemical reactions that we'll need to talk through in that respiratory chapter. Let's see, I did the first one for you on page 55. Let's do the second one up there on blood pressure. So if you happen to have low blood pressure, the example says that you had somebody drinking alcohol, and the catch to look for is the pressure issue. That tells me what type of receptor is going to pick up on this problem. Baroreceptor, good. That information is taken to your cardiovascular center. Why is turning on the sympathetic stimulation going to help us out? Yeah, increases heart rate and increases pressure. Keep in mind that heart rate and pressure are a tag team. It's kind of like a 1-2 punch. And so we're going to increase epinephrine to the SA node of the heart, increasing the rate. Vessels will constrict again, and of course that increases blood pressure. So that's the bottom line, is if you've got low blood pressure, you want to raise it. This is just simply how you get there. You get there through sympathetic stimulation. Did you get this one done correctly?
Okay.
But you got the big picture? Okay. Anything I can clear up on this one for you? Okay. Any pictures before I change slides?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So the next three are chemical issues, and the only three chemicals you want to be worried about for this topic is blood pH, CO2, and oxygen. Okay? So those are the only three chemicals that we're going to worry about in terms of neural control of blood pressure. This one is alkalosis, and so right there is one of our three issues. Sometimes people have vomiting that can lead them into alkalosis. Another situation that may lead to alkalosis could be an overdose on Tums, Rolaids, Alka-Seltzer. Some antacid can also lead you in that direction. So alkalosis means that we've got a pH imbalance, and the way we fix that is by letting our chemoreceptors tell our cardiovascular center. So what we're going to do is decrease sympathetic stimulation and increase parasympathetic stimulation to the heart. Let's take these one at a time. What's going to happen to your heart rate?
It's going to decrease.
Decreases, okay. And then secondly, we can't innervate your vessels with para. So what happens to your vessels over time?
They
They dilate, yes. So it's a lack of sympathetic stimulation that eventually lets your vessels dilate and relax. So ultimately, we see decreased heart rate and decreased blood pressure. Let me give you the big picture here. You may wonder why somebody who's been vomiting or taking in acids may have a slower heart rate. It's about retaining more CO2 because CO2 behaves as an acid. That's something we're going to get to later on with acid-base balance. Any questions on this one? Did you get this one right? Okay. Let's see, our next one is a carbon dioxide issue. It's excess CO2 called hypercapnia. Okay. And so, again, it's a chemoreceptor that tells our brain about the problem. This time, do you turn on sympathetic or parasympathetic? Sympathetic, good. What happens to both heart rate and pressure?
Increase,
good. So which neurotransmitters are involved?
Epinephrine
and norepinephrine, good. And, of course, SA node fires more quickly. And what happens to the diameter of your vessels? They constrict, right. So like we talked earlier, this is what happens during exercise as a way to make sure your blood pH and your CO2 levels get back to normal. Any questions here? I wonder how many hundreds of pictures I have photobombed over the years.
No, I tried.
I figured you guys
see
do.
You like,
I see the camera cut on my moving over. Yeah. If I'm pointing, I'm like, oh. Okay, last one on hypoxia, which means low oxygen levels. See, I'm doing it again. It's just automatic. So with hypoxia, low oxygen is going to stimulate the brain through chemoreceptors. And again, if you don't have enough oxygen, you want to get everything going faster. Breathe faster, heart rate faster, blood pressure goes up. So what I'm leading you into is understanding how heart rate, blood pressure, and respiration all are linked together. Did you get this last one okay? Not that one? Did hypoxia as a term throw you off? Okay, I know, yeah, that's kind of a weird term there. Do you need extra practice with these? Sure. Let's see. Specifically because it's an oxygen issue, I'd call it a chemoreceptor rather than a baroreceptor. Okay. Yeah, look for my clue words. If it says high pressure, low pressure, you know it's a baroreceptor. If it says anything about CO2, oxygen, or blood pH, it's a chemoreceptor. Okay. This is a good place for a break, mental break and everything else. So why don't we have about a 5-minute break, come back about, that thing is fast, isn't it? 2:05, why don't we do about 2:10, 2:12, and then we'll start on page 56 at that point. Let me repeat her question. That stuff we just covered on neural control of blood pressure is both multiple choice and an essay. What I'll do is I'll pinpoint parts of the process. I'll say, so-and-so has low blood pressure because of X problem, and I'll say to you, what kind of receptor? Or I'll say, what's the vasomotor center going to tell your vessels to do? Or is heart rate going to increase or decrease? So, you know, you'll want to think about pinpointing all the steps of the process. And then there's a guaranteed essay that I'll throw out at you, one of those issues, and I'll say, okay, walk me through the negative feedback loop, and you'll want to be sure and cover what the heart's doing and the vessels are doing to solve the problem. So, like she said, you know, that's a type of topic that you want to study for in two different mechanisms, two different ways. Just a little left here, we've talked about neural control, so now we're going to talk about chemical control of blood pressure. You actually make a little histamine. Do you remember which type of white blood cell? Basophils, good. They are potent vasodilators, meaning that they are really good at their jobs. So if you've ever had an allergic reaction where you have itchy eyes, you know, runny nose, all that good stuff that comes along with allergies, that's a great example of a histamine reaction. Likewise, if you've ever had systemic hives, you know, hives all over the body, that too is the basophils having a great time dumping their granules. So no fun for that stuff. Nitrous oxide is another one that we make. Our blood vessels actually make it in small amounts, and they do that to help relax or dilate themselves. Imagine if you could make something to make yourself relax. How crazy is that? So, we actually use nitrous oxide in the dentist office because it is a vasodilator. Now, why do you think a patient who's receiving nitrous oxide will also wear a pulse meter or an oximeter? Yeah, to make sure enough oxygen is getting to these extremities. So, what would nitrous do to your blood pressure and your heart rate?
Decrease
it, yes. So we just want to make sure enough is getting distributed there. You've probably heard of huffing, right? Okay, so that's unregulated nitrous oxide that people get by inhaling the nitrous from those cans. Get some brain damage that way, yeah. Nicotine is not something we make. It is something that's found in tobacco products. And, of course, nicotine is a potent vasoconstrictor. So that is one of the reasons that smoking or cigarettes or tobacco products can increase blood pressure because of the vasoconstrictive aspect. Let's see, that takes care of chemical control. And then finally, we've got hormonal control of blood pressure. We've been here before with this in the endocrine chapter, so let's just summarize what we've got. So we've got epinephrine and norepinephrine. What impact do they have on blood pressure and heart rate? Increase, good. You'll notice that beta blockers are listed there once again. What effect does one have on blood pressure? Decreases, yeah. Yeah, beta blockers will lower heart rate and blood pressure. So the intended effect may simply be a lower heart rate, but if you take a beta blocker, the blood pressure may also fall as well, so they kind of go hand in hand together. Let's see, antidiuretic hormone, we know, is also known as vasopressin. How does it increase blood pressure? Good. Constricts vessels and holds on to the water. Good. So on your worksheet there, it says, why do you think a patient might receive vasopressin rather than epinephrine as a way to increase blood pressure? It's primarily on the vessels. That's it. Good. So vasopressin's effects are primarily on the vessels. What does epinephrine talk to besides the vessels?
The heart,
yeah. So vasopressin primarily affects the blood vessels. Let's see, angiotensin II, we've talked about its buddy angiotensin and renin already in this course. So it is one that is a potent vasoconstrictor. It also activates the release of aldosterone and ADH. For people who have high blood pressure, they may take a drug called an ACE inhibitor. That drug actually prevents angiotensin II from being created. What impact will an ACE inhibitor have on blood pressure? Decrease it, yeah. So ACE inhibitors decrease blood pressure. And like we talked back in the endocrine chapter, the only hormone that directly lowers blood pressure is ANP, and that one is atrial natriuretic peptide. What hormone does it work against? Aldosterone, good. What impact would ANP have on your urine?
Increase it.
So increase your urine output. That pulls water out of your body. Why is pulling water out of your bloodstream going to help lower your blood pressure?
Because it changes the viscosity.
Changes the viscosity. And what is the number one influence over blood pressure? Cardiac output. Yeah. Blood volume, exactly. So pee it out, there goes your blood volume. All right, so that takes care of our three kinds of blood pressure control. We've talked about the vasomotor center and the cardiovascular role. We've talked about chemicals, and now we've wrapped up with those hormones. How about questions so far?
What's the first one?
Yeah, beta blockers lower pressure. Completely switching gears. We're going to head to page 58, talk about bulk fluid transport at capillaries. So we know that gas exchange, nutrients, waste products can all be moved across capillary walls because they are thin. In fact, they only contain what tunic?
Intima.
Good. So what type of tissue makes up the capillaries walls? So it's thin walled enough for items to travel across. Some things, like, say, gases move simply by diffusion. Other things, like nutrients, may have to be moved by facilitated diffusion. Now, fluids are a different case completely. Fluids are moved by pressure gradient. So we know the old adage with diffusion. We know that items or solutes travel from high to low concentration. That is the same issue here. We are moving fluids from high to low pressure. So we've got two things to talk about to kind of lay the foundation. We need to talk about the types of fluids that we're dealing with, and we need to talk about the two major battling pressures. Okay, so let's first talk about the two major types of fluids. We have intracellular fluid, or ICF for short. Where is that found?
Inside.
Yeah, inside cells. That makes up around 2/3 of your bodily fluids. You know, it's amazing to think that you're toting around 20-something plus liters of fluid. You know, that's a lot of water that we're toting around. So 2/3 of that is tied up in storage inside of your cells. The other 1/3 of your bodily fluids are in the extracellular compartment, and a couple that we're going to pay attention to, blood plasma. And what is IF?
Interstitial
fluid. So that's the fluid outside your cells that's not in your bloodstream. The next thing we need to talk about are two battling pressures. The first pressure is one that you've heard of before. We just didn't call it osmotic pressure back when you studied osmosis. Instead, we told you a catchy way to keep straight where water always goes. What does water always follow?
Salt.
Good. So that means that the higher the osmotic pressure, that means that there's more salt in that compartment, and water's going to move to that compartment because the solutes cannot move. So with osmotic pressure, we are looking at basing that on salts, solutes, and proteins. Keep in mind, these items cannot travel across the cell membrane. They're stuck on one side or the other. Okay, and we're going to call this one BOP for short. That stands for blood osmotic pressure. And osmotic pressure is going to attract and pull fluids to the saltiest or most protein-rich compartment. The second major pressure is called hydrostatic pressure. Keep in mind the prefix hydro indicates what?
Water,
good. So we've got water-based pressure, that of course is blood pressure, and we're going to call it BHP because that stands for blood hydrostatic pressure. Just want to repeat this. Hydrostatic pressure and blood pressure are the exact same thing. Okay? Hydrostatic and blood pressure are the exact same thing. Hydrostatic pressure is based on the fluids in your bloodstream. You know, that's mostly water. And we know that this is a force that pushes fluids out of your vessel. So here's your battle. You've got a pulling pressure battling a pushing pressure. So we just kind of need to set the stage. And what I'm going to do is go down to our capillary now and put in some pressures. You don't have to memorize the numbers. If they stick, then that's great. But I'm not going to ask you on the test what a value is for any particular pressure not related to this bulk fluid transport. So let's see a big picture for just a moment. When blood is flowing through a capillary, the pressure is highest at the arterial end when you come in. As you flow along the length of the capillary, what happens to blood pressure?
Decreases.
Okay. So the alternate name for blood pressure was hydrostatic pressure. And hydrostatic pressure is about 35 millimeters mercury at your arterial end. That's the end that blood is coming into this capillary. Under ideal, normal circumstances, we see that blood hydrostatic pressure fall. It's going to reach around 15 to 17 millimeters mercury at the venule end of your capillary. Just to keep us straight, does hydrostatic pressure push or pull?
Push.
Good. So I'm going to make a note here that hydrostatic pressure pushes, and that's going to help us follow how the blood and the fluids are going to flow. Blood osmotic pressure is a stable, steady 26 millimeters mercury. That means the solutes and proteins that you have in your bloodstream don't really change too much along the length of the capillary. Even when you reach the venule end, your blood osmotic pressure is still approximately 26 millimeters mercury. We're going to keep in mind that this pressure is one that pulls fluids towards the highest solute concentration. One more little tidbit of trivia is this. Out here in the interstitial space, there is just a little bit of osmotic pressure and a little bit of hydrostatic pressure. OP, of course, osmotic. IF stands for interstitial fluid. And then there we've got our hydrostatic pressure of the interstitial fluid. These are about 1 millimeter mercury or less. So, you know, when you're looking at a battle between 35 and 26, you know, would be if there's one, right? That's not a big influence over the overall battle. So we're going to pretty much ignore the interstitial fluid pressures. They play pretty much no role in our overall battle. All right, battle is set. Let's take the arterial end of your capillary. Here we have a pushing pressure of 35 millimeters mercury and a pulling pressure of 26. The higher number wins the battle. Who's your winner?
Push
it, yeah. Okay, so this is called filtration. Okay, so when this hydrostatic pressure pushes fluids, we filter it out into the interstitial space. We call this filtration. So how did we accomplish filtration? Which pressure had to be the higher of the two? Hydrostatic, right. What if your osmotic was the higher of the two at this end? You wouldn't push it, you'd pull it, yeah. So we're basing this on everything being normal and ideal, and that we've got a high enough hydrostatic pressure to be able to push against that osmotic pressure. What is creating that osmotic pressure in the first place? Salt, water?
Salt.
Salt, yeah. So salts and proteins in the bloodstream are trying to pull the fluids in, but the push and force of that pressure is what pushes those fluids out. So we're pushing fluids along the length of this capillary, okay? And then eventually, it's kind of like taking a tire or a hose that is expected to have pressure and poking holes all in it, right? Eventually, the fluids leak out and you don't have any more push behind it. When you reach this venule end of the capillary, you'll notice that our blood hydrostatic pressure has kind of lost its steam. We're now down to 15 to 17 millimeters mercury. That is the pushy pressure. The osmotic pressure is pulling with an overall force of 26. The higher number wins the battle, so who's your winner? Osmotic, yeah. It's going to pull fluids back in, and what do we call the process of returning those fluids? Yeah, this is reabsorption. I should tell you that only 90% of the fluids that are pushed out get pulled back in. That means 10% of those fluids get stuck in the interstitial space. So this is an entirely inefficient process, but the good news is we do have a system that's picking up those escaped fluids in the interstitial space. What system is that? Lymphatic, good. So lymphatic vessels weave their way through these cells and tissues, and they say, hey, fluid, you didn't get back in the vessel. I'll take you back. So these lymphatic vessels down here pick up that escaped fluid. You know, this seems like a minor issue. Only 10% is not returned back to the capillary in a day's time. That is 3 liters of fluid that you can lose to your interstitial space. What happens to you when you get fluids out there?
Edema.
Swelling edema. Right. So edema is the term for all these excess fluids. So these lymphatic vessels are critical for picking up those escaped fluids. So once again, I'm going to cut you guys loose for a worksheet. There's one on page 59. There's about 15 questions there. If you have an old version, all I did was expand the questions just a little bit. Let me let you work on those for a few minutes, and then we'll get back together and do answers. Okay, so on page 59, let's work through those questions.
Yes.
For number one, we're looking at how hydrostatic pressure changes, and it drops from around 35 to the mid-teens along the length of your capillary. So basically, it drops from a high pressure to a low pressure. You might say that pressure decreases, but the bottom line is we go from around 35 to around 15 to 17 millimeters mercury. Number two, let's see, we've got the drop in a pressure that allows interstitial fluids to travel back in. What pressure would that be?
The BHP.
Yeah, the BHP. It's got to drop in order for BOP to be able to pull the fluids back in. So number two, the drop in BHP. For number three, plasma proteins are kind of like salt. What do they do to fluids that are outside your capillary?
Pull them in.
Yep, so they pull fluids in the capillary.
What was
number three? Number three, albumin, like plasma proteins, they act like salt, and so they pull fluids from the interstitial space into the capillary.
Also, being that they're
They are large and they don't leave the capillary, but they've got the same pull power that, say,
okay,
salt does.
That's what, okay.
Yep. For number four, we're looking for why fluid returns to the capillary at the venous end, but not at the arterial end. Good. So pulling it into the capillary versus...
Oh, the capillary,
sorry. Okay. So which pressure had to drop?
BHP,
good. And that allows BOP to pull the fluids back in. Okay. So yeah, for number four, the BHP had to drop in order for BOP to pull fluids back in at that venous end of the capillary. In order for BOP to pull fluids into the capillary at the venous end. So BHP had to drop in order for BOP to pull fluids into the capillary at the venous end. All right, let's see number five. We've got what happens to fluids that are not picked up. Yeah, lymphatic system, good. Number six, which pressure is responsible for filtration?
BHP.
Good, BHP, that's the pushing pressure. And number seven, which pressure is responsible for reabsorption?
BOP.
Yeah, good, BOP. Number eight, what would happen to fluid transport if BHP exceeded BOP at the venous end of the capillary? Push it, yeah. You would have no reabsorption. You would continue pushing out fluids. That's called filtration. So yeah, filtration would continue, no reabsorption. All I can think about is salt and pepper when we talk about this stuff. Yeah, filtration will continue, no reabsorption. Seriously. Thank God for the Geico commercials, because at least somebody knows what I'm talking about, right? Most of my funnies are like dated, you know. Okay, number nine, if escaped plasma proteins cannot be picked up by the lymphatic system, the proteins are your clue, right?
Mm-hmm.
What pressure is affected?
BOP.
BOP, yeah, because BOP is reliant upon salts and proteins. If you can't reabsorb interstitial fluid, now which pressure is affected? BHP, yes. So number 10, BHP is affected. So, of course, BHP is relying upon fluids. Number 11 is a good one to think about. The liver makes plasma proteins like albumin. This is like an essay question, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You need much more room than a blank. Okay, so let's take the first question. Why would a liver disorder like this one lead to edema? Let's see, albumin's not made, so which pressure is affected?
BOP.
And the big deal for BOP is reabsorption at your venule end. So if you can't reabsorb, what happens?
Oh, stays in the
stays out in the interstitial space, right. Yep. And that lymphatic system only picks up at a certain speed, so it can only pick up so fast. So excess fluids out here would be edema. What is the answer? That's a good question. Why would liver disorders lead to edema? Decreased BOP means fluids stay in the interstitial space. Okay, so why would liver disorders lead to edema? Decreased BOP. Leave fluids in the interstitial space. Decreased BOP leaves fluids in the interstitial space. Okay, so decreased BOP leaves fluids in the interstitial space. There's your answer to the next one. The pressure that's affected, that's BOP, right?
Mm-hmm.
And why would that particular pressure be affected? Osmotic pressure depends upon solutes or proteins. Okay, so BOP is reliant upon solutes and proteins. That last question, why would that particular pressure be affected? Because BOP depends on solutes and proteins. I need to give that one an A, B, and a C breakout.
Yes, I know.
It's too many
one
here.
Question there.
BOP is reliant upon or depends upon solutes and proteins. So far, so good? Okay. Let's see, number 12, how does high blood pressure affect edema or cause edema? Pushes it out, right. And if it's so high, it would overwhelm your ability to reabsorb, right? It's going to keep pushing. Yep. So high BHP continues to push out fluids. Okay, so high BHP continues to push out fluids, and that's what edema is excess fluids in the interstitial space. What do you think about number 13, salt water? What does that do to your BOP? Increases, yes. So if you increase your salt intake, like from salt water, your BOP increases. Let's say instead of 26, it was like 40. What would that do to your reabsorption ability?
Increase it.
So what would happen to your interstitial fluids?
Decrease.
And they'd be pulled back into that capillary. Yep, so drinking salt water is going to pull fluids from the interstitial space into the capillary. So for number 14 there, edema once again is extra fluids in the interstitial space. Let's take one by one. What might happen to your hydrostatic pressure that would lead to having too much fluid in the interstitial space? Too much hydrostatic or not enough?
Not enough. Too much.
Which is it?
Too much.
Too much. Yeah. So. Yeah, push crazy out to the interstitial. And how about osmotic pressure? How could that lead to edema?
Not enough.
Yeah, so not enough pull, not enough BOP would also lead to edema. So too much BHP, not enough BOP. And final question, what situations might increase the return of fluids at the venule end of your capillary? Well, you could increase BOP, decrease, you got it, yeah. Do one or the other, or do both actually. Increase BOP or decrease BHP. I bet your brain is full now. Okay, so we'll finish up this stuff on Monday with lymphatic system.